Welcome to Disarming Leviathan. My name is Caleb, and this podcast is designed to equip you to missionally engage American Christian nationalists. I'm joined today with Brian Kaler. He is the editor and president of Word and Way. He's been there since 2016 in that role. He's also an award-winning writer and an expert on issues of religion, politics, and communication. He is the host of the award-winning podcast, Baptist Without an Adjective. He's written multiple books on religion and politics, and he's written a new book that we talk about today called Baptizing America, How Mainline Protestants Helped Build Christian Nationalism. It's coming out in July of this year, 2024. And this book, which we talk about in this episode, explores how the seeds of Christian nationalism were not only found in evangelical churches back in the 1900s and earlier, but also in mainline denominations. And this is really helpful as we get a history of Christian nationalism in America, specifically in the American church. And we also talk about a lot of the subtle, more nuanced ways that Christian nationalism can kind of creep in to a church community. So I really enjoyed my time with Brian. I think you will enjoy this podcast. And so without further ado, here is Brian King. All right. So Brian, you just wrote a book, and I think that the topic is really fascinating. Tell us about the book and why you wrote it.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me on, and it's good to be here with a July book launch buddy. I mean, I think everyone needs to buy two books on Christian nationalism this July.
Yes.
Disarming Leviathan, and then also, hopefully, I hope your listeners will add Baptizing America.
Yes.
How Mainline Protestants Help Build Christian Nationalism. And so, you know, I've been looking at the same things you've been looking at these last several years and being alarmed, being concerned, particularly, you know, not just the threat to democracy, but, you know, the heresy and how it's impacting our churches. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a conservative Southern Baptist congregation. And so these are my people that I see, you know, that are the 81%. But I'm also in a mainline congregation now. And I have a co-author, Bo Underwood, who's a Disciples of Christ minister and has always been in that context. And so as we've been writing about Christian nationalism, as we've been interrogating the heresies of Christian nationalism, one of the things that we kept noticing was that a lot of the quote evidence that you will, if you will, that Christian nationalists today point to, be it, you know, Speaker Mike Johnson or, you know, an activist like David Barton or a preacher like Robert Jeffress, like what they point to try to prove that America was supposed to be a Christian nation and that they're supposed to have the privileges, all the things that Christian nationalism tries to do by fusing Americanism and Christianity. The stuff that they point to are things that mainline Protestants created. And it's a part of the story that's not often told. And so we started digging into that and realized that it was a whole lot worse than we realized, which is normally how these types of stories go. And so I think it's important, one, to understand how we got to where we are. And it's not just a Trump problem. It's not just a conservative evangelical problem. The rot actually goes much deeper and much farther back. And then also, not only does this help us understand how we got here, but then also now, how do we deal with Christian nationalism? How do we detox from Christian nationalism in a lot of churches and denominations that may pat themselves on the back, and they look at the January 6th insurrection and say, you know, thank God I'm not like those insurrectionists with that crazy Christian nationalism.
Right.
And they still have the flag in the sanctuary too, right? And they still have the history of Christian nationalism in their own context. And so that's the goal of this book, is to broaden the conversation.
So just real quick, help us understand, you used two words there, evangelical and mainline.
Yeah.
What are those things?
That's a great important question. Basically, Protestant world is divided into these two camps.
Okay.
And they're roughly, in the polling from like PRI right now, they're roughly the same. Although for most of American life, the mainline Protestants were the dominant religious tradition. And that's true up until around the 60s and 70s. When we see kind of the rise of evangelicals. And so mainline Protestants have historically been those sometimes they're called the seven sisters. There's kind of seven key denominations, although there's a lot of other denominations that are considered mainline today. But these are ones that were kind of leading at the founding of America and throughout most of American history, like the Episcopal Church, like the United Methodist Church, American Baptist and the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, the Presbyterian Church USA, And then on, you have your evangelical side, you'd be, you know, you've got your Southern Baptists and a lot of your non-denominational churches and these different traditions. And what we find is that this dividing line between mainline Protestants and evangelicals runs through most traditions. Hmm. So you have, you know, evangelical Presbyterians and mainline Presbyterians. And sometimes the terms can even be confusing, like in the Lutheran world, the largest Lutheran denomination, the evangelical Lutheran Church, is actually the mainline Protestant one.
Right.
Whereas the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church is the evangelical one. And you know, with Baptists, right? My own tradition, you've got Southern Baptists are evangelical, American Baptists are mainline. And so you can see these traditions running. And a lot of it comes down to how we read the Bible, how we minister and preach and evangelize and all of those different things. It really does shape theological life, and then sometimes it also shapes engagement in public life.
Hmm. Okay, so that's helpful. So we're thinking about inside Protestantism, so within Protestant Christianity, so we're not talking Catholic or Orthodox, Coptic, whatever. We're specifically thinking in America, in what we call Protestantism, there's two divisions, evangelical and mainline. And in this current moment, we're having a national conversation about Christian nationalism, political combativeness, polarization, partisanship. And we're looking at things like January 6th, and we're thinking nationally, this is an evangelical problem. And what I hear you saying is, well, it's not just an evangelical problem. It's actually a broader problem that actually is within all of the church, but specifically within Protestantism, we're thinking about mainline denominations. So what have you found in your work, thinking maybe to our history, where you find these seeds of Christian nationalism or the root of it in some of these mainline spaces?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's so many examples we could pull from. And let me just maybe pull out one of the many examples that we deal with. Sure. In the book. Like I said, a lot of the quote evidence that people will point to today to say, oh, we're supposed to be a Christian nation, is actually coming this. So we could look at, for instance, Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm. Or, you know, the national model, right? In God We Trust. You know, each of these things. Those are things that are coming into place because of mainline Protestant politicians and mainline Protestant preachers. Particularly, we have this period in the 1950s, 1960s, where there's this really Christian nationalistic revival when all this stuff is getting codified into American life. So, for instance, Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, we'd had a Pledge of Allegiance for decades by that point. And there's a little bit of debate now exactly over who might have written it, but the until some new scholarship came out, 2 years ago, the general story all along has been that there was this Baptist preacher, a Baptist socialist, which is always fun to think about. People don't think about those two terms going together, but this Baptist socialist is the one who's generally been credited with writing the pledge, and he wrote it godless, right? There is no under God in the original pledge, and it sits that way for decades. Mm-hmm. And then we get this effort, mainly mainline Protestants. In fact, there's a key moment where a Presbyterian pastor is preaching a sermon arguing for the inclusion of under God. And he's preaching the sermon that day because he knows that President Dwight D. Eisenhower is sitting in pew, right? Wow. And so this is a sermon designed for one person, mm-hmm. and that we need to convince people that under God should be put in there. And it's not this simplistic, like, generic unifying idea. He is very explicit in his sermon that this is to be a Christian nation, mm-hmm. and that he even calls atheists spiritual parasites. Ooh. In American life, right? And so he's essentially excommunicated, at that point, only a couple percent of the American populace, but still, mm-hmm. he has excommunicated some citizens of the United States based solely on their religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. Now, in our more pluralistic society, that today that becomes an even greater problem.
Right.
But again, it's the mainline Protestants who put under God in the pledge to kind of baptize our nation and tell some people that, you know what, you're not really American enough, or you're not mm-hmm. a good enough American because you don't believe in the Christian God. And again, we see that language is so important today. The under God, Michael Flynn points to it. David Barton points to it. They always talk about, see, we are one nation under God. That's the way we're supposed to be.
Right.
And this is a problem that was created in the 50s, thanks again largely to mainline Protestants.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. So the author of, well, some scholarship is pointing, the author Francis Bellamy of the Pledge of Allegiance, that it got edited in the 1950s. So right. Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And what I'm understanding you to be saying is that In God bit was actually edited in the mid-1900s. Mm-hmm. Same with our currency and things like that. Even though it's coming from this mainline space, it's interesting to note they didn't tell you which God. That there's this assumption that we all know what we're talking about here, that what we mean is we mean the triune God of the Christian scripture, not Yahweh or Baal or Mammon or so why didn't they just say one nation under Jesus?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is this sense. I mean, so a little bit it was, there's always been a little bit of a nod to, okay, well, there are some Jews, so we'll be a little bit inclusive. Like, you get that is a little bit of it, right? But again, the authors are, when they say God, they do mean the God that's also incarnated in Jesus.
As we all understand it here in this particular cultural moment.
Yeah, and when you look at the demographics of the nation, I mean, we are a nation of Christians at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, largely Christian and particularly largely Protestant. And so I think it was easier then for them to just kind of be like, this represents basically all of us. And I think it was still problematic there. There was, while it was a small minority of the populace that was kind of defined out of being a good American, it was a small part. Mm-hmm. And so while it was problematic then, it has become more problematic today. And that's one of the arguments we make, is that the Christian nationalism that maybe mainline Protestants were building was maybe a kinder, softer, less dangerous version.
Right.
And part of that was because there wasn't as much pluralism in the country.
Yeah.
But Christian nationalism becomes even greater threat to government, and particularly a democratic system, small d democratic system, as a nation becomes more pluralistic, because then a greater number of people are being defined out of citizenship.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a scholar out of Denver Seminary, Ryan Talafowski, who did his research on the Christian response in Germany to the rise of fascism through the Third Reich. And one of the things that he noted was that nationalism, religious nationalism, or even ethnic nationalism, rises in the seedbed of an increase of pluralism. So the more that my community changes, the more that the people I see at the grocery store don't look and act and worship like me, the more I'm anxious that something's going to be taken from me or I'm going to lose my way of being in the world. And so nationalism presents itself as a solution to that anxiety. So thinking about mainline Christians in the 1900s, what was their anxiety? How did that become manifest? And how did the thinking of a religious or Christian nationalism express itself in the churches?
Yeah, so if we go back to that Presbyterian pastor with the Under God sermon, it's communism. It's the Soviet Union, right? And so here we are in the early 1950s. The Cold War has just started. We are at the start of a nuclear era, which, I mean, you and I are both young. You know, we're younger than that. We weren't around at the birth of this kind of nuclear era, where there was a lot of apocalyptic sense of like, wow, like the world is careening out of control. We're going to just blow the whole thing up. And obviously that's still a threat. It's still a danger, but it maybe doesn't feel as fresh or as on the cusp of disaster because we've survived for decades in a nuclear world. And so we still have to be vigilant, but it doesn't feel like it's the nuclear war is just around the corner. And so that's the anxiety that I think that we're sensing a lot of that. And there's also, then there are cultural changes that are happening. There is the civil rights movement is happening, and there's a lot of shakeup that's happening. And while a lot of mainline Protestants were on the right side, there wasn't uniformity there. And so there is some of that cultural change and anxiety, role of women, who many had gone to the workplace during World War II, and some still wanted to have their jobs even after all the soldiers come home, right? And so there's a lot of cultural change that's happening. in the 50s. And so that does seem to have this sense of anxiety, a different anxiety than we're experiencing today with evangelicals that are looking at, again, increasing pluralism, the dramatic rise of the nuns, a sense of, you know, a country that's becoming more racially diverse. And so for white evangelicals, it can feel like the country doesn't look the same as it did when, you know, they were younger. And so it's a different type of anxiety that might be driving some of that, you know, excitement about Christian nationalism. But yeah, I think that that idea of anxiety, of change, is being scared of change. Yeah. Is so critical, which is part of the role then of pastors, right? Like, how do we help people to, you know, fear not, and, you know, instead of, you know, being driven into something like Christian nationalism?
Yeah. Yeah. Frequently, we're experiencing pastors that I've talked to, and myself included, we're hearing from our congregation deep and profound fear. Fear of the outsider, fear of losing something very precious, my way of being in the world. You know, my community is changing, and so there's fear of being a stranger in your own home. And those fears are very real. And one of the things I find myself doing frequently is saying, well, let's imagine we were under the Roman Empire as Christians. Like, what would we feel fear? And so you're just trying to normalize. The kingdoms of this world are always doing their thing. The world is always changing, and we're not home yet. Like, we sing it all the time. You know, one day in the sweet by and by, or the Apostle Paul talking about, yeah, I'd like to depart from you and be with the Lord, but not yet. That we have this resurrection hope in the new heavens and new earth. And yet in this moment, we feel deep anxiety. And so we reach for the sword of Christian nationalism to try to protect what's ours, what we think is ours, forgetting the hope that lay ahead, I think. And so this is very common to like all Christians at all times, just seems different for us. You mentioned the idea of a softer, gentler form of Christian nationalism. I think looking back on the 1950s and 60s, 70s, and the Christian engagement with nationalism, we might look at that and be like, well, that's just patriotism, right? Having a flag in the worship center or sanctuary, that's just patriotism. Singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee" on the 4th of July in worship, that's just good old-fashioned patriotism. That didn't lead to January 6th. So how would you help us see how those things weave together?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, because the patriotism question is definitely an issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's just take the flag in the sanctuary one, because, I mean, we spend some time unpacking that because it's such a significant issue. If we think about this theologically, right, when we're coming together to say that we worship the God of all creation, the God of all of the world, of all of the nations, but then when you put a flag of one nation in there, there is this suggestion that God loves this country more than the others. And especially when we start singing the songs on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
That might be a softer version. It's not the now grab your guns and let's go storm the Capitol, but we're discipling people for generations into seeing that there is not a contradiction between their nation and patriotism on the one hand and their faith and Jesus on the other. It gets particularly worse when we also put the Christian flag there in the sanctuary.
Because
we try to do this like two kingdoms thing, right? Like, see, we're citizens of two kingdoms. But we nearly almost always follow the U.S. flag code. And that is, the U.S. flag code says where the American flag is in conjunction in relationship to other flags. And so if it's on stage, the American flag will be on the right of the preacher, and any other flag is supposed to go to the left. Well, that, or if it's on a flagpole, put the American flag up on top. That's called the place of preeminence in the U.S. flag code. And so what we're saying in the U.S. flag code is that the American flag, it trumps the others. It's the chief allegiance. And so it's actually worse to put the Christian flag in there and put it in the subservient position.
Wow.
This is no longer two kingdoms theology. We are saying exactly what Jesus told us. You cannot serve two masters. And so either we think the American nation and Christianity are one and the same and never conflict, which is Christian nationalism and is heretical, because no empire of this world is going to perfectly align with the teachings of Jesus at all times. And I would even suggest much of the time.
Yep.
But like, we have to acknowledge that there are going to be times when patriotism tells us to do something that's contrary to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so we will choose a master. Jesus said we cannot serve two of them, and we've already decided which one we're going to serve. For generations, we have discipled people in saying, this one is first, because we have put it in our sanctuary in the chief position. And so when it comes down to when they fall into conflict, we're Americans first and we're Christians second.
Yep.
So yeah, it may not lead us to storming the Capitol immediately, but we have discipled people into being ready to accept that kind of Christian nationalism today.
Yeah. Yeah. It creates a community where people who do storm the Capitol feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They see it as their Christian act, the Christian duty.
Yeah. In the iconography of January 6th and many of the Christian nationalist rallies, you see crosses, Christian flags adjacent to American flags. Oftentimes, one of the things I've seen is they will actually merge the two things together. Yeah. I was just browsing a particular website that sells flags that you can hang out in front of your house. And there's like the Let's Go Brandon flag and, of course, the American flag. But then there's various versions of the American flag, the blue line, the red line. But there was one where it was fascinating. It was the American flag that was cut down the center and draped kind of like curtains on in a theater. And behind it was a Jesus figure on a cross and an American soldier kneeling at the cross. And that iconography, that conflation of Americana with the Jesus way, is communicating these two things are synced up. This technical term would be syncretism. It's taking elements that are foreign to the way of Jesus and syncing them up with the Christian tradition and saying these are all the Christian tradition. And if you've ever talked with missionaries who've gone to a different culture and just ask them what is syncretism, and they'll say things like, oh, well, you know, these people became Christians. They started following the Jesus way, but then they still had their shrine to so-and-so, and they're merging them together. That would be syncretism, and we see that in a lot of the iconography here. So it's subtle sometimes. It's not always as vivid as the product I just described. What are some other ways, Brian, that we're seeing seeds or flavoring of Christian nationalism in the church? Thinking about like the 70s up maybe even to today, last 50 years or so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so one of them, and this is actually embedded in some of the hymns some of the songs we might sing on the Sunday closest to 4th of July or, you know, to a lesser extent, Memorial Day or Veterans Day, is some of them that are in a number of Christian denominational hymnals still today do also kind of conflate the sacrifice of an American soldier with that of Jesus for us, right? So he died, and now they also died for us. And that then starts to suggest that to die for your nation is to die for God. Which, by the way, like if you want to see Christian nationalism in effect, is literally what Patriarch Kirill of the Russian Orthodox Church has said about their invasion of Ukraine. Yes. He has said that any Russian soldier who dies fighting in Ukraine, it wipes away their sins. It's a salvific act. Right? Mm-hmm. And so if you want to see a vision of dangerous militaristic Christian nationalism, it's the Russian Empire today. Mm. But it's also in our churches in the United States as well. And again, it's easy to have that patriotic feeling about the self-sacrifice of a soldier and to honor that. But we also have to draw a really clear line and say, but that's different. That's different than what Jesus did. Mm-hmm. And that no matter how much we might honor someone for dying for their nation or dying, you know, sacrificing themselves to save some other's life, whether, you know, it's a police officer or it's just, you know, somebody on a, you know, boat trip and, you know, jumps in and drowns saving someone else, right? We can honor that without saying that it was itself a salvific act or that it was, you know, it was, they were fighting for God, because that's really dangerous. And a lot of Christian nationalism seems to really be wrapped up in war. We see these revivals of Christian nationalism in times of war. War fuels Christian nationalism, but then Christian nationalism also fuels war, which makes sense, right? You know, if you're saying your nation is the best, most important nation that's ever existed, this is God's greatest nation, which is something we hear a lot today in our political rhetoric, then to fight for your nation against anyone else is to fight for God, even if it means we're killing Christians on the other side of the border.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think it's in Tim Alberta's book. He, I think, is quoting Orwell, who said, you know, patriotism is defensive in its posture, wants to protect its family, its people, its nation. Nationalism is offensive in that it wants to conquer and dominate. And I think that that's a, it's a helpful way to maybe think about the distinction between patriotism and nationalism. Patriotism, very similar to how I love my family, why I love my people, right? I don't love my tax code and my, you know, government, but I love my people. I love our way of being in the world. I love my nation, even if I don't like the state or the country, you know, the government systems. Nationalism is, and we should go out there and make everyone like us, and we should dominate, and we should own, and we should control. How do you hear rhetoric, pastors, ministry leaders, authors, how does the rhetoric that you're hearing or engaging frame up or promote nationalism, maybe even under the guise of patriotism? So what are like words that we're hearing or talk tracks or I'm thinking in particular about like the religious right movement in the 1970s and 80s. How have you seen that at play in churches through ministry leaders and authors?
Yeah, I mean, so I referenced just a moment ago the line that you'll hear a lot of times about United States is the greatest nation God has ever created, which is always an interesting argument considering Israel's status in the Bible. Right. But I mean, we hear that rhetoric all the time. I hear it from preachers, you hear it from Sean Hannity, you hear it from politicians, and so that rhetoric is getting right to the point. Like God has made us special, more so than any other. And that goes, like you said, that goes well beyond the patriotism of being happy, proud to have been, by accident of birth, born in this country, and so when we're talking about like in churches, though, like that's not the purpose of why we gather. You know, we don't gather because we're Americans. We gather because we're Christians. And the temptation throughout all of history has been to conflate those two. I mean, we've talked about the Roman Empire. We've talked about Nazi Germany. I mean, I really like the way Tony Campolo has talked about it, about, being proud to be an American is different than, seeing it as the something other than Babylon. He said, everybody's always tempted to love their nation, even though their nation is Babylon. He said, I may think this is the greatest Babylon on the face of earth, but it's still Babylon. And that's what patriotism is, right? I'm proud to be an American. I'm happy to be an American. I think it's the best Babylon ever. But then as a Christian, I still recognize that it's Babylon.
Yeah.
It's not the kingdom of God. It's not God's gift to the world. We see that, I think about, George W. Bush in his State of the Union, reaching back now here several years, but talked about the power, wonder-working power, which of course was a throwback, to the hymn that we all know. But it was not of Jesus; it was of the American people.
Yeah,
that was the conclusion of the power, wonder-working power of the American people. I mean, that should drive us nuts. Instead of being like, "Oh, that's so great!" Like he's quoting our hymn; he's one of us. It's like, no, he's right. Bastardizing the hymn. To pervert the meaning of it. But we get excited when we hear politicians quoting scripture out of context about America.
Right. So we've got politicians who oftentimes use the Bible to buoy their partisan perspective or their political argument or their political power. How might preachers and ministry leaders incorporate that into like a Sunday sermon or into a thing they say, explicitly saying like America's the greatest, nation. God made America the greatest nation in the world. What are some other ways that you might hear it in the preaching or in the talk track in the churches?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it, a lot of times, might not even be at the sermon time. Okay. Sometimes it might be the prayer time, which I mean, this as a pastor, you can preach a lot during the prayer time, or even just like the prayer announcements.
That's right.
You can work in some critical, important details there. Having moments of prayer for the American soldiers or for our nation every single Sunday, but never for other nations, or never for, you know, there are ways of just like, again, it can be subtle, but it's that way of slowly discipling people into viewing their nation as more important, that God loves us more, that God really is on our side. And again, this particularly becomes dangerous when we have war and we start to view the war as holy, as a crusade, and that God is on our side. Yeah. You know, I always think of the Bob Dylan song where he goes through all these different wars that, you know, God, we were told God was on our side, this war and this war and this war. And then finally at the end, it's like, if God is on our side, he'll stop the next war. Right. But, you know, the preachers need to help us in getting to that point as well, instead of praying for one side and not for the other side. And so, I mean, I always, when I talk to pastors about this, I always think, you know, one of the best things we can do to confront Christian nationalism is to help our people view their faith more globally. You know, I mean, which we are part of a global faith. I mean, anytime something happens in the news, there are Christians there in any country. And so how do we lift those up? Right? I mean, so when October 7th happens, there are Christians in Israel, and we can lift them up, and they're a small minority community there. And then when the bombs start falling on Gaza, there are Christians there, and we can lift up their voices, and we can pray for them. And this isn't about taking sides with one government over the other. This is about recognizing there are Christians literally caught in the crossfire on both sides of that violence, and that are being killed on both sides of the border there. And so lifting that up, I think, is how we start to, again, it might seem very subtle, but that's how we fight back against the way that patriotism too often bleeds into Christian nationalism.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see it explicitly in warfare. God, I remember after 9/11 and our leadership as a country, using this language to refer to our enemies, political enemies, they're the axis of evil. So if they're the axis of evil, what are we? Well, we're the good guys. And C.S. Lewis has this great line, and I don't recall exactly how he said it, but it's something like, if this is a war between good and evil, then it is a war of total annihilation. If they are evil and we are good, then we must annihilate all evil. And he's arguing, you know, when we use this rhetoric, we forget ourselves, that we are also propagators of evil, that we have also not lived according to the kingdom of God. And so this is a war between a bunch of broken people with national interests. It's not good versus evil. And yet, when a country goes to war, ministers feel this expectation or pressure from their congregation, tell us we're the good guys. Make sense of this. Make this easy for us to understand. Or justify this use of violence. Pastor, we need you to justify this use of violence. So pastors will often step into those spaces with nationalistic rhetoric or a nationalistic idea. So this seems to be like baked into the system, Brian. I mean, it just as you're using your sharing your examples, I'm just seeing this all over the place. You wrote a book. You did a ton of work to do that. What are your hopes for those of us that are going to engage with your material? What are your hopes for us?
Yeah. So part of what we're trying to do with this book is to help whatever church or denomination you might be a part of, to look at this not as, that's a problem of those people over there, but where has Christian nationalism showed up in my church? And where has it shown up in my tradition? And where have I fallen prey to it? Because it doesn't really matter which denomination or church you grew up in. If you grew up in a white Christian church in the United States, Christian nationalism is just in the air we breathe. And so then it's that hard work of separating, detoxing, figuring out what was American and what was the gospel. And so that's what we really hope people will do is after reading through it and seeing some examples and seeing the history, and that they will then look at their own church and say, all right, what do we need to do? How do we confront Christian nationalism here? Again, rather than just that judging part, you know, the oh, look at the speck in their eye, or even for some, the insurrectionists, the massive big plank in their eye, mm-hmm. but noting that, you know what, we also have a plank in our eye too.
Yeah.
And so how do we do that work? Because honestly, if you're a Christian who's listening to this podcast, you're already one who's concerned about Christian nationalism. You're ready. You want to see a change. And so the most fruitful areas are going to be to start with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like if we want to really reduce the amount of Christian nationalism in our nation and our churches, let's start with those who are ready to have that conversation and do that uncomfortable work that might make us feel like, yeah, that's not exactly what I thought we meant. I thought we were just upset about the people storming the Capitol. But like, right. Now July 4th looks a little bit different at church. But that's okay, because maybe we can find something more meaningful to replace it.
Mm, that's so good. So your book is coming out soon. I want to encourage everybody to get it. Remind us of the title and where we can find it.
Sure. It's Baptizing America. The subtitle is How Mainline Protestants Help Build Christian Nationalism. I mean, you can find it pretty much anywhere that you can pre-order books. It'll come out July 9th, so the week after Disarming Leviathan. And so you search for it anywhere. You could go to publicwitness.wardenway.org. That's where I write about Christian nationalism on a regular basis, but also we have information about the book there as well.
Cool. And for those of us not familiar, tell us just briefly about Word in the Way.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate that. Word of Way has actually been around since 1896.
Did you found it?
Yeah, right? I know. I've only been there since 2016. I was elected as the ninth editor, so in 125 years or so. Yeah, only nine editors. A week after Donald Trump's election. And so this has been the era in which I have led Word of Way. But we were founded as an independent Baptist publication, looking at Baptists and, you know, Northern Baptists, which are now your American Baptists, as well as Southern Baptists in a Midwest region all across the area. And we're even more ecumenical now in our approach with our staff and who we cover and so forth. But that's our history. And so, yeah, we try to lift up voices against Christian nationalism, to confront Christian nationalism where we see it, as well as other types of resources, and just helping churches and Christians think about the gospel more deeply, what it looks like in ministry, and what it looks like in public life.
Cool. Well, Brian, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I really appreciate it, man, and I look forward to getting that book.
Yeah, well, it was an honor, and I enjoy talking with you. Thanks.
Absolutely. All right. Bye, everybody.